What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to So Very Wrong About Games, the best podcast you are listening to right now. I am Mark Bigney, and with me, as always, is my loyal co-host, Mike Walker. How are you doing, Walker?
Hello, everyone. Hello, Mark.
Hello, Walker. Answer the question, Walker. How are you doing?
I'm doing fantastic.
I am very glad to hear it. So this week, we're going to talk about board games. We're going to talk about our as-yet-unnamed retrospective intro segment, the Eurus. We're going to talk about the games we played last week. We're going to talk about the news and why it doesn't matter. And our topic this week, which is going to be the virtues of popularity, something we both know a great deal about. And before we get started, though, I'd like to have a sort of a lifestyle insert. I just want to relay something that happened to me today. Now, I am not one who likes to bash religious minorities, but I have to say that I still do not understand the sleeving lifestyle. I resort to sleeving as a last resort. I have to sleeve because I wanted to bring my Sakura arms up to date with the new Season 5 translations, and for that you need to slip the lovely little inserts that people have painstakingly translated in with the cards, and you can either sticker them with stickers or use sleeves and slide them in. And so there I was in trepidation, descending into the game store, not really knowing how this whole sleeve business works, because here's the thing that I don't quite get. The word standard is used quite a bit in the sleeve industry. Standard this, standard that, standard and other things. How could there be 23 different standards? And even then be variations within what constitutes standards.
I don't know. I don't understand it myself.
All that happens when I get sleeves is I get something that I think works, give them money, and then come home to realize that none of the dimensions fit. I walked in and a good friend of ours happened to be there for an X-Wing tournament. I nearly swooned and collapsed into his arms with tears streaming down my face. I thrust myself into his tender mercies and he was like, yeah, I guess this is what you need. And sure enough, they don't work. So,
well, that's why Fantasy Flight, you know, came up with this wonderful color coding system and did their own sleeves, because then, you know, you don't have to worry about any of this stuff.
Yeah, I have to say, well, that's the thing with being a sleever, right? You have to pick an on-ramp. You have to devote yourself to a certain company's output and just commit long-term, and heaven help you if that company goes under or changes product lines.
Agreed.
I don't understand. I just don't. Anyway, our Eurus, roughly last year, we reviewed Level 7 Omega Protocol,
which is a one versus all science fiction alien type get in there and shoot some machine guns with giant robots and or flamethrowers and or gas filled rooms.
Well, that's how you do it. You always play the heavy or the meat sack.
Yes, it is true.
I tend to show up with the rifleman and deploy lots of bots. Anyhow, have you played Level 7 Omega Protocol since we reviewed it, Walker?
I don't think I have.
I have played it once or twice, and this, I think, is a function of two things. Number one, it's a function of the fact that the 1v-all dynamic, as we commented in the review, is very, very particular, and it's not for everybody. Playing the overlord or the bad guy or running these things is a very tricky thing, both socially and in terms of gameplay. And although we both think Level 7 Omega Protocol does it better than any other game, it's still a little bit touchy, shall we say. And the second reason is, quite frankly, when I'm in the mood for something like this, I'm almost always in the mood for a co-op version. And we have been spoiled for co-op versions of, hey, do you want to go and mow down waves of enemies in any number of formats? So I don't think it's a comment on the quality of the game. It's just insofar as it's a very particular niche, the 1v-all mode. And the 1v-all mode, the market's mostly moved on. I mean, Level 7 American Protocol was published in 2013. And at the time, good solo systems hadn't quite been perfected to the extent that they have now. And there's just been a deluge of co-op versions that we've been more than happy to play instead.
And they had a big Kickstarter for this, didn't they?
They did. They changed a whole bunch of stuff. They updated a whole bunch of stuff, and they reprinted things. Now, it was a strange Kickstarter program because they didn't offer upgrade packs for old users. Now, they were called upgrade packs, but it was just reintroducing all the new content that they put into it. There was a smattering of new missions and new equipment and stuff, but to get the new versions of the cards, all the errated stuff, all the, you know, the normal things you would expect from a first to second edition, no support whatsoever. All you download the PDF, and then what you have to do is make mock-ups of yourself, perhaps, of course, using sleeves.
That is very odd. I agree.
I commented at the time that when fulfillment was happening, a whole bunch of users in my situation, people who had the first edition of Level 7 Omega Protocol, were saying, I thought I was supposed to get the new cards. And then a number of other people saying, I thought so too. And then I carefully scrutinized the pledge level, and they don't actually mention that you get that, but a whole bunch of people were in the same position I was. We had gotten the false impression that we were getting the updated version, when in fact we weren't really. It was a strange Kickstarter, but I'm glad it's in print. I really do. I mean, it's worth the effort to get it to the table now and then, because it really does a lot of things extremely well, particularly in that 1v-all dynamic, which again is not a dynamic I frequently want, but it is really good. I wish I played it more. To be frank, I don't think I'll play it more often than I do, which is to say maybe once or twice a year. But that's only because of a preference for co-op and the fact that the market is saturated, very nicely saturated, with excellent, excellent alternative offerings.
And it has a really interesting mechanism, right? All running all through that world is how the aliens feed off the tension or the adrenaline of their opponents, of the humans, right? So it's one of these things where the more you do, it generates these tokens, which the main overlord or bad guy can use to, you know, deploy his troops or do extra or interesting things. And I think they do a great job of that.
Yeah, it's a wonderful, wonderful game. And honestly, if there were somehow a co-op version, I'd probably play it more. But again, that's merely a preference thing and a group dynamic thing. Again, for 1v-all games, I have yet to see anything even remotely approach the quality of Level 7 Omega Protocol. But then again, it's not really a fertile design space for the past few years.
And that is the game that we reviewed last year?
Ish.
Now on to the games that we played this week. Mark, what did you get to play this week?
It was a really good week for gaming, I have to say. There were a couple of duds, and I'll talk about that, but I want to start with the game that I most wanted to play for the longest time, and that is Guards of Atlantis 2 by Artem Nechiporov at Wolf Designer. And he has sent me the early versions of some of the files, and I very painstakingly, with sleeves, printed up a lot of the mock-ups, and so I got to play with some of the new characters, got to play with some of the rebalanced characters. Actually, what happened was, under the general aegis of our New Year's resolutions and fulfilling our New Year's resolutions, a local listener to the podcast, whom I shall call Dr. Handsome, approached me during a common game night. People were splitting off to decide what to play, and he said, so, how's your resolution to decide what gets the table going? And I said, not well, given that those were the first two words that I'd said ever since the discussion about what to play had happened. And he said, all right, what do you want to play? We're playing that. And so with his assistance, we corralled two other people and we played Guards of Atlantis 2. It was marvelous. I specifically, Walker, if you recall when we played at Shucks, there were your two characters, you and your partner, you had a difficult time getting them off the ground because they were a little bit trickier and they were not well suited against the playstyle of the two characters we picked, or at least not transparently so. So I deliberately picked the character that your partner had played, namely the Angry Bear, who is not very mobile, and that is a challenge to play well in a game where you have to cover a lot of ground.
Considering he needs to be adjacent to his enemies as well.
Well, that's just it. Yes and no. And so it was very instructive and illustrative. I don't know that I would have been able to play nearly so well with this character had I not seen what had happened previously. And the thing is that his job, the Angry Bear's job, or at least the way that I played him, because different builds could play him a different way, is not necessarily to kill a whole bunch of things, but to lock down areas of the board and make it very treacherous for enemy heroes to get close. And in so doing, I was able to basically pin both opponents, both of their heroes, and prevent them from operating at full capacity. Meanwhile, my partner just went around the periphery and murdered everything. And I was able to trigger his special abilities with great effort. But that's one of the things about Guards of Atlantis, and we commented on this frequently, is that it's difficult to get some of the special abilities to work, but when they do, you feel brilliant. And it was amazing. It was joyous. It was I'd been waiting so long to play it again, or what felt like an eternity, and it was absolutely marvelous to see both the new characters and the old characters brought up to snuff. It was great watching people discover their characters and discover how to make different builds and react to the different environments. And first, we wanted to try to win by pushing the minions, and then that wasn't going to happen, and so we had to make a pivot, and we started building towards murdering opponent heroes, and I would lock them down and threaten them, because the Angry Bear, in addition to a variety of forced discard abilities, he can force opponents to discard cards under the right circumstances at range with difficulty. He's also a stat monster, and so he's very, very difficult to bring down, so I was absorbing all these attacks, and when he attacks, if you're stupid enough to end your turn next to him, he will hit you real hard.
Like an angry bear.
Very much like an angry... I hadn't thought of it that way, Walker. That's, there you go. Thank you for the perspective.
Very profound, right?
Yes. I could go on for a long time, but one thing to note is that the version that I was playing with has already been obsoleted. The development work has still been going on apace. I am not going to be going to the tremendous effort of making sure that my copy is always up to date, because that's a fool's errand, and quite frankly, the printer ink alone would bankrupt me. But the development work that's going on in Guards of Atlantis 2 is absolutely wonderful, and I was so happy to play again, and quite frankly, I'm going to try to keep playing this version again to just see more of the characters. The roster is so deep and so diverse now. I had an absolute wonderful time playing Guards of Atlantis 2, and I cannot wait for the final version to come out.
So you played with some of the new characters. Did you make any board modifications? Because they changed the board slightly as well.
They did change the board. We played with the older board, but with all of the new rules. So I did notice that in the newer board, when you push the lane, using MOBA parlance, of course, there's a bit of a catch-up mechanism in that the defenders, the people who are close to losing, start off with one extra minion as compared to the opponent. That's not true in the original board. In the original board, the balancing was just the placement of the minions. The quote-unquote defenders, their minions were further back, and so it was harder to get to them. But I don't really recall enough of the changes of the board to comment too deeply on how much of a difference that'll make. But again, new board layouts just leads to more variety in a game system that is already going to be drowning in it once the second edition hits. So, as I say, can't wait for the Kickstarter, can't wait for fulfillment. Love me some Guards of Atlantis, and Guards of Atlantis 2 seems even better.
You got to introduce me to the game you talked about last week, which is Las Vegas Royale, which is a fantastic little dice-chucking filler game. Comes with nice little components, nice little dice tray that you huck the dice in. Tons of little mini-games that you set up every round, top or bottom side. You flip them around, and it has all these different areas that you want to control. And when you put dice in there to control them, it'll trigger abilities and let you do fun, interesting things. It's a nice light game, and I agree with you that it's a great little filler game. Probably not one that I would choose, but still, it wasn't terrible in my eyes.
You seem to find it very frustrating.
I was just looking for more of a decision space, right? And I see, like, we both, Louis that we were playing with, him and I both got on the wrong foot in the first round, where we both rolled a lot of the same number and then just, dumped all our dice into one section where we didn't understand that it's best just to see where people are going and, slowly filter out. And
yeah, it's an area majority game.
Exactly.
And in an area majority game, you don't want to overcommit right from the outset, because then you're just getting pretty poor returns.
Yes.
I don't see that as a detriment to the quality of the decision making in the game.
No.
I'm not defending it
as
an incredibly deep game.
I didn't understand. We both didn't understand that right off the hop. So on the very first roll, we almost dedicated all of our dice to the first spot, and therefore that the rest of that round we only had a few dice left to move around. So it was the first round was a wash, and then we slowly got into it.
So what I'm hearing is that you have all these grapes, and
yes,
your grapes have gone sour.
They're very sour.
I see.
Very bitter.
I see.
Yes.
No, I agree. It's a good filler. I think the decision-making is pretty quality for the length of time involved and the rules explanation involved. I'm a big fan. And that was Las Vegas Royale.
By Rudiger Dorn.
So here's a public service announcement, Walker. There's a disease that infects the gaming community. The technical name is Diminutive Losty Derangement Syndrome, but gotcha. The more common name is Tiny Epic Derangement Syndrome, or TEDS.
Oh, my Lord. Gotcha.
And you and I both know someone who's afflicted with a very serious case of TEDS.
We do. Quite badly, actually.
TEDS kills 3 million Americans every year.
It's true. Well, you need a slow infusion of games like Big City or, you know...
So, as a result of our close association of someone who suffers from TEDS, every once in a while, Gamlin will shovel out some tiny epic dross onto the shelves of gamers everywhere, and we get to be subjected to this. And... this individual who suffers from this disease, it's an illness, right? So you don't want to blame the victim, first of all. And secondly, as I said to Huey last week, we shovel enough crap in front of his face that he'll happily play. So I figure we owe it to him every once in a while. So I got to play, I played Tiny Epic Tactics. And I gotta say, by far, it is the least offensive Tiny Epic game I've ever played. Which is to say, it was kind of okay. The... rough setup is that you're kind of sort of almost but not really playing a one-on-one little tactical kind of skirmish combat game thing. Here's the thing. At two, it is tolerable. At three or four, it's garbage. It just leads into all the multiplayer business because, of course, you have these quote-unquote heroes with, say, 12 hit points and attacks do 3 or 4 hit points at a turn. Well, guess what? You only get points for knocking them out. So multiplayer is just a crazy last-hit nonsense smorgasbord where frequently you're just sitting there thinking, do I want to hit this guy? Well, he's at full health. I'm not going to knock him out. So why would I want to hit him and make someone else's life easier? Eh. So you end up with this weird pseudo-positioning thing. Anyway, it's all right, I guess. It does that very, very cute thing whereby the box bottom is turned upside down and now it's terrain. And you put this on top of a mat and you put other little pieces of box out and they form elements of the terrain. It looks very cute, honestly. You play with these little embossed meeples that are nominally representative of the four classes and you get a different person of each class. And all that stuff is fine.
And it's crazy unique classes, like ones you've never heard of, like elf and dwarf and human, right?
No, that's not true, actually. You have an archer, you have a magic user, you have a fighter, and you have an animal of subtype.
Oh, that's crazy.
I had a monkey that could pick people up and then drop them off. And my opponent had a heavily armored elephant who seemed pretty overpowered, but... Such was our experience with the initial animals. Look, at two players, it was fine. Would I rather play any one of half a dozen better two-player tactics skirmishy things? Absolutely, 100%. It reminded me, actually, of how unfortunate it is that Titan's Tactics didn't take off. Because in a very real way, it's very much like Titan's Tactics. Very, very small footprint, very quick and dirty sort of skirmishy thing. Titan's Tactics is... roughly 17.7 times better than Tiny Epic Tactics. And this is to say nothing of things like Warhammer Underworlds or any number of other skirmish games that are available. Anyhow, it was mostly inoffensive. And that, for me, is high praise when it comes to a Scott Ulm's product. That was Tiny Epic Tactics.
You and I got to play a game called In the Hall of the Mountain King.
Designed by Grieg, I think. Oh, no, wait.
It's designed by Jay Cromer.
I believe Jay Cormier and Graham Jans, or Jans, I couldn't tell you.
Anyway, you're playing trolls and you're digging out your burrow not to get too close to the center of the volcano, and you're unearthing your statues, your heritage statues, and you're getting points and you're getting all these minerals and stuff to hire more trolls. I guess, so you can unearth boars. Anyway.
You put the trolls into your trolls moot.
This being said, it wasn't a terrible game. I enjoyed playing it. I felt as though it suffered from this busy work, right? It's like, you know, pull all the resources in. I get two of this, three of that, four of that, and then I, you know, pay it all back out again. Or I transform this into that, I transfer that into this, and then I pay it all out so I can get even more back in again so I can pay it all out again. It did have that interesting resource management, right, where you hire these trolls, you make an interesting pyramid, and every time you enter a troll, that's when your resource gathering triggers, right, and you gather everything down the pyramid unless there's already resources there. So it sort of like funnels you into spending those resources before you hire, and that leads into my, you know, last remark where it seems to be this constant handcuffing. Where you don't want to spend resources because you don't want to do a suboptimal action where, you know, you're not going to get some resources, or you don't have enough to build the tunnel you need, so you're forced to get a troll, or you're forced to build it, you know what I mean? It seems you're always being forced in a certain direction.
Well, I think I wouldn't necessarily put it in terms of being forced. I think there is a tension between doing the suboptimal move or doing a different suboptimal move. Because you're right, there's this timing issue, and I think honestly that's probably the most interesting thing in terms of gameplay of In the Hall of the Mountain King, because resources usually sit on your trolls, and you can't get any more resources on your trolls while the resources are there. So you want to spend them before getting a different troll so you can maximize your throughput. But that will force you to play inefficiently in other ways. And so that tension I thought was kind of interesting. And it drove a lot of the tempo of the game, because the game ends when somebody has finished their troll pyramid. Everything's pyramids. You have a pyramid of trolls. You buy the trolls from a pyramid of trolls. I'm shocked that this game didn't have an ancient Egypt theme.
It's a Illuminati thing, I'm sure.
Oh, okay. Sure, sure. So you take your Fnords. I'm sorry. You take your trolls and you go and do these things. And whoever gets their 10th troll triggers the end of the game. Now, and through the all the troll management stuff I thought was actually kind of neat. The rest of it, namely building your polyominoes on a tile grid, I found less interesting. Partially because I'm not a huge fan of spatial puzzles, and partially also because when it comes to tile laying, I think there are, roughly speaking, three categories of tile laying. There's the tile laying where you're just laying tiles for your own personal private network, a la Papillon, which is how I'm going to try to say it in English. There's tiling where you're kind of sort of interacting with other people, like in the Hall of the Mountain King, because you can't have your networks intersect at any point. You can only block people by the corner principle. You edge up to people, and that forces them to play suboptimally. I much prefer tiling when it's like Carcassonne or Tigris and Euphrates, where you're actually all playing on the same tile grid. That maximizes player interaction, and I think also maximizes visual appeal. You have this interesting sort of evolving situation. Now, I like other tiling games, like Bad News Bears is of the first category, and it's pretty enjoyable. But I just found myself wishing that the board mattered more and that the placements were more interesting and did more for me. It was fine. The game was fine. It was diverting. It didn't outstay its welcome with three. With four or five, I could see downtime being an issue, because you're right. You're spending a lot of time saying, okay, I get one of this type and two of this type and one of this other type, and just waiting for people to wrestle with that could be somewhat unfortunate.
Yeah, and like you said, I wish the map meant more, and the cool statues that were on it, you know, the most interesting part of the game really didn't mean too much. Of course, it was the essential part of scoring, but they just sort of like sat there on the map. You moved them around a little bit, but anyway, and that was In the Hall of the Mountain King.
Burnt Island Games certainly knows how to put out a pretty production, though. We had the deluxe version, and I have to say, this was probably the one time where I looked at a game and said, you know what? I bet you the game trays are really going to make life easier, because they separate all the polyominoes up by pile, and that part was a luxury. Finally, I got to play something I've been looking forward to for a long time. This is the reprint of Demacher. This was put out by Spielworks late last year. Fulfillment's been kind of rolling out over the past few weeks. This is the legendary Eurogame by Karl-Heinz Schmiel, the legendary Eurogame designer. And I will point out, first of all, that on the box, very optimistically, there's a sort of drawing of Karl-Heinz Schmiel, and it says number one, hoping that there will be many, many more in this series. We know they're going to be reprinting Tribune, which, for my money, is the greatest worker placement game ever made. And hopefully they'll get to more of Karl-Heinz Schmiel stuff, because he was a really, really good designer. Anyway, I had no idea what to expect coming into it, because I'd read the rules, I'd seen the rules changes from previous editions, I played the second edition Demacher, I've played the third edition Demacher, and this is kind of the fourth edition now. They've all had varying degrees of rule differences, but the differences between second and third edition on the one hand and fourth edition are pretty big. Some of them are pretty fundamental, but at the end of the day, it's all about winning votes. It's about German politics. As somebody with a bit of a politics background and with a small bit of knowledge of post-war German politics, I really like the theme, and getting into a little bit of role playing is always nice, but of course nobody else at the table knows who the CDU or the SPD are, so I'm usually alone when trying to do that. So you might have heard legends about Demacher, and I'm actually going to do a more in-depth review of Demacher on So Very Wrong About All the Games You Like Are Bad later. But suffice to say that they've cut down the length considerably. However long you used to think Demacher was, I hear people talking about how Demacher is a 5-hour game, which I think is absurd. I can get a second or third edition Demacher set up, explained, played, and taken away in under 4. But this edition is now pretty much a 2-hour area majority game, which is to say, very, 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 very playable in terms of length. This is with 5 players.
And four of them that had never played before.
And I was the only experienced player of any version of DeMocker. Now, we ended up taking longer, but that was with extensive pizza breaks. I advertised the event as Pizza und Politik. Yes, it was very sophisticated. And this, again, was under the aegis of satisfying New Year's resolutions. I wanted to do event gaming, and so I invited people over and did DeMocker. And
I'm surprised that you got the pizza place to cut it in the German fashion. That was pretty interesting. I'd never seen a pizza place in Kingston cut it that way.
Oh, you've never had pizza until you've had German pizza. The German shapes are just fundamentally more aesthetic.
So true.
At any rate, it was really good. I think the changes are almost all for the better immediately. The only changes which I'm dubious about, I'm just not sure if I prefer the old version or the new version. One of the things that they've changed considerably, which is a frequent topic of consternation, is the polls. You auction off poll cards. And it used to be an open auction, and the consequences could be tremendous. So you'd see people bidding exorbitant quantities of money, either speculating or out of fear. In the new version, it's a once-around auction, so turn order matters a lot, but it ends with whoever's in the lead in the province. So if you have a built-in advantage in a province, well then, you're better off winning it later on, which is very nice. And so, again, a lot of the changes were of that ilk. Streamlining things, cutting things out, instead of doing 6 rounds of 7 elections, you now do 4 rounds of 4 elections. This is in the short version. You can do the longer version, which will turn into 5 rounds of 7 elections. So it's not quite very much like how when Fantasy Flight reprinted Merchant of Venus, and they said, oh, well, you can play the old version, when it was an approximation of the old version. They didn't advertise this, Spielworks. They didn't say you could play the old version, but they said, oh, well, you can do the 7 election version if you want. But it's still radically different in structure from the previous 7 election version. Anyway, I could go on and on about these differences, and as I said, in a different venue, I will. But as far as meaty, quality decision-making area majority games, DeMocker is and always has been excellent. And now it's in a version that is roughly 2 hours long. And as I've been saying frequently in the context of heavier Euro games, and I'll be probably repeating this for years, if you have lots of mechanisms and sub-mechanisms, I like it when A, they fit together in a reasonable way, and B, they funnel down into comprehensible victory conditions. And in DeMocker, it's both of those things are true in spades. The way media influence feeds into your ability to manipulate the issues, which feeds into your ability to protect you from polls, which feeds into your shadow cabinet, which feeds into a whole bunch of other things, is wonderful. And the victory conditions are incredibly simple. You're involved in politics. Get votes. That's how you win. Yes, there's a couple other marginal ways you can get points, but you want to win votes. And that's incredibly intuitive, and nobody's scratching their head thinking, wait, how does the game end? How do I get points? This is worth how many points? No, it's very simple. Everything is very clear and transparent from that sense. One of the people there actually commented, who plays a lot of Euro games, and comments that even for a lot of middleweight games, he finds it difficult to conceive of how everything gels together. He commented halfway through the game that he had no difficulty internalizing how all of these systems intermeshed, despite the fact that there are a fair number of them. So, DeMocker is a wonderful game. It always has been. The new edition, I think, is excellent. If you're a fan of DeMocker, I think this is an excellent version to try. If you've never played DeMocker and any of this sounds interesting, I think you do yourself a disservice if you've never played any version of it. And this is an excellent place to start. So I think kudos to Spielworks for their work on the new version of DeMocker. I cannot wait to see what they do with Tribune, which is always a game I preferred. And I think that if they keep reprinting Karl-Heinz Schmiel games, then he might get his reputation back that's kind of been in a lull because he hasn't published a whole lot in the past 10, 15 years. And so that was my experience with DeMocker.
And those are the games that we played this week. Now, on to the news and why it doesn't matter. Mark, we both love Era, Medieval Age.
We do.
It's coming out with an expansion. Saw some pictures of it, Mark. It looks fantastic. Makes it look even nicer, if that was even possible. Cute little cobblestone roads with bridges over the rivers. Can't wait to see it. Can't wait to see how they incorporate that into the game.
So all that we have so far are renders, but I agree with you. It looks adorable. And we both highly recommended Era Medieval Age. I think it got our number one components of the year, both of us in our end of year roundup. The only concern that I have, and this is an incredibly petty one, is the insert for Era Medieval Age is so perfect. And there's no room for anything else. I'm a little concerned about how this is going to integrate with the base game. But this, as I say, is a very, very petty concern. I cannot wait to see what happens. They also threatened in the rulebook for Era Medieval Age, they threatened other versions, other settings, other, well, eras, if you want. And I'm very much looking forward to it. I think it's great. Small bit of news on the Kickstarter police. You commented not too long ago that you were waiting for the Kickstarter police to finally come in and clear house.
I've written right here. We're probably going to talk about the same thing. I have Kickstarter police written here as
what
well.
What do you have to say about the Kickstarter police?
Mark, I don't think it's going to happen. Because there is a game out there, Mark, that is... It's up to 2,600 people have pledged for this game. It's made $113,000 American dollars.
Hasn't made any money yet.
Sorry.
People have pledged.
People have pledged yes. to pay this amount of money. There is no designer accredited. There is no artist credited. This particular publisher that's putting it out has no background and no library, except for they have one Kickstarter that has not yet even shipped, which is a broom vacuum.
Okay.
Yet all of these people are still pledging for this game. So my prediction of the Kickstarter police and people starting to police themselves has fallen completely out of the window. And
well, tell us about this game. It sounds awesome.
No, Mark, it's some sort of weird Monopoly meets Catan, where it actually has you're migrating to Mars, and it's an actual roll to move. So you move your little rover D6 spaces. And if you land on a resource, you pick it up and then you trade it with other people. And
well, Mars is red hot right now.
Well, you might land on somebody else's hotel. thing, in which case, it seems very painful. I'm wondering if people even looked at the rules. I don't get it.
Well, if your news item is that people pledge for some dodgy stuff on Kickstarter, allow me to tell you. Well, no, my news was about the Kickstarter police actually exerting some power.
Oh.
We've mentioned a couple times, but there's been a lot more mention of the various alleged shenanigans and misdeeds of a certain company called Golden Bell. And the way they abuse Kickstarter backers and the way they abuse their collaborators and designers that they've worked with. Well, they've been banned from Kickstarter.
Oh.
Kickstarter has announced that they are no longer allowed to post Kickstarter projects for a variety of... shall we say, shenanigans. And so it looks like Kickstarter does indeed have a threshold that they're, you know, beyond which they will not let people go. Now, I'm the first to admit, if Golden Bell Kickstarters brought in, say, the amount of money that Simon Kickstarters did, maybe they wouldn't do this. And I say this only half cynically. But it looks like they are willing to take action at some point. So no more Golden Bell partnerships on Kickstarter for the foreseeable future. So they do, they sometimes take action.
So on my last bit of news, just more on a prediction thing, is because, you know, I got to pull back now all my predictions because, you know, on more consideration and more thought. It was just the Terraforming Mars, where I said there was going to be no more expansions for Terraforming Mars. I failed to understand the fact that maybe there won't be any more expansions. So what does that mean, Mark?
I understood that less of a prediction and more of as an idle wish.
The fact that there's no more expansions means now it's time for Terraforming Mars, the big box. Not saying that's been announced or anything, but I'm sure by the end of the year, there will be one. So I'm just modifying my prediction. How's that?
I will say this about Terraforming Mars. I did see that in one of the newer expansions, they now actually have two-level boards. So the components have been getting slightly better.
Well, that's one thing.
Yeah, it's something. Anyhow, that is the news and why it doesn't matter. And now we move on to our topic this week, which I have decided to label the virtues of popularity. Were you popular in high school, Walker?
Oh, terribly so.
I could see you being very popular in high school. You were a jock, right?
Yes, I was.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, here's the only thing I know about popularity. You should wash your hair once every 2 weeks. Once every 2 weeks.
Okay.
That is my guide to popularity.
Whew. Man, if it was that easy.
So why don't you tell us a little bit about our conception of this topic?
Well, my conception of this topic, and I think you sort of might have fallen in line or understood what I meant, was the fact that I'm trying to understand why certain games are deemed good or why certain games are doing well where others are not. And is a game being popular reason for it to be called good, i.e., because it's being so well received, because it's being played by so many people, because so many people are able to talk about it, is that a characteristic of a game being good?
So I think there are two categories of things to talk about under this topic. One of them is directly addressing that is the aesthetics. The aesthetic argument as to what do we mean when we call a game good, and is there a version of that? We're not going to do a definitive exegesis of what it is for a game to be called good, but we can nonetheless explore whether it is a legitimate aesthetic judgment to say this game must be good because it's so popular or something along those lines. And then, on the other hand, I'd just like to talk a little bit about how there are definitely other virtues, independently as to whether or not a game can be called good by virtue of its popularity, there are other virtues to a game being incredibly popular, both for the hobby and generally and for the people who play it. So that's some other stuff that I want to talk about, and I'm sure you'll have things to contribute there. So let me just start by talking about, again, not a robust, comprehensive analysis of goodness, because that's the entire field of ethics. But mostly when I talk about a game, I'm talking about its quality as a design, right? I talk about its design qualities. When I say that a game is good or bad, or good or bad for me, you know, we can get into the subjectivism, blah, 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 blah. But I think that in terms of the overall design quality, saying that it has to be a well-designed game because it is popular with lots of people, that I think is a straightforward application of a very, very common logical fallacy, which is called the appeal to popularity. Something has to be true because it is widely held to be true. Well, that's been a fallacy for millennia, and it's obviously false. So I don't think, and maybe you're going to push back on this, maybe not, I think it is reasonably uncontroversial to say that its quality as an artifact of design doesn't necessarily have any strict connection with how popular the game is.
Nope, 100% agree.
Okay.
Wondering, like, when reviewers talk about how they endorse a game or how they give a game the you know, tell people to pick it up or something that they should look into.
Are you talking about us or other people?
Just reviewers in general.
Okay. So including...
Not us.
Okay.
We
so other people.
other reviewers might do this.
Okay.
Do they do it only because it's popular? Only because...
Oh, wow.
Only because they feel as though maybe they also feel this push. Maybe they feel as though people will enjoy it because so many other people are enjoying it.
Huh. So I think there's a number of different things to unpack there. One, the first thing is we should, of course, rule out the people who do previews. Right? Because previews are paid adverts, whatever.
Correct.
And, of course, when games get more popular, sometimes that leads to more marketing or more marketing buzz and so forth. And so maybe it has more volume of things there. Or maybe the same factors that will lead it to become popular lead it to being in an environment where there are more previews and such. Like, for example, I think we can say that whatever else you want to say about Stonemaier Games' designs, they are very, very good at generating positive media, regardless of how successful the game is. And I know this because Charterstone was not well received. But Charterstone got a lot of positive buzz and a lot of attention. On the other hand, something like Tapestry or Wingspan, which did very well and was very well received, also had that same kind of, not necessarily the same volume, but it's been going up as time goes on. So we can separate out all this, you know, preview stuff, all these paid reviews. And I think we can legitimately dismiss as either not existing or not worth talking about the kind of individual who will say, I'm going to say that I enjoyed this game even though I didn't, because that's the popular opinion and I'm afraid of going against the grain.
That's correct.
I don't know how many people talk like that. I suspect the number is approaching zero. Maybe there are a bunch of them. I don't know, but I sincerely doubt that that's a prevalent attitude. Then there's the middle case, though. And this actually is partially about popular games, and it's also partially about reviewing. How much of a job is it for the reviewer to start imagining contexts in which a game will be successful? You know,
this is what I'm talking about. Yeah.
Okay. So why don't you try to articulate what kind of review process that might look like? No, seriously, what is that sentiment?
Well, I just mean like this will work in a particular group or their experience with the game so far, bringing it to conventions, is that everyone's enjoyed it, or just the general feel around the game itself has been so positive that they disregard the actual mechanics of the game. Just the fact that everyone seems to be caught up in the buzz and or the push forward of this game, and therefore all of their experiences with the game have been positive, so they just sort of portray that out in their review.
Well, but you said we were talking about other people, but we do that all the time as well. Sometimes a game, we have a category for it. Worst game you enjoyed. We do it every year. We talk about games that are mechanically unsound, or we think have elements of design decisions that were bad, and we think we could or ought to have been improved, but nonetheless work. Sometimes it's a theme thing, sometimes it's a component thing, or whatever. I don't think that's what you're talking about.
No.
I think you're instead talking about an individual, and again, I'm not sure how common this is, but it's an interesting thing to think and talk about. An individual who brings a copy of a game and tries it out with a whole bunch of different groups, and they don't like it, for whatever reason. maybe it's because of bad design, or maybe it's because of any a number of other things, and they don't like it, but everyone they've shown it to has, and everyone out there, quote unquote, seems to really enjoy it. Is that what you're talking about?
A little bit, yes.
Okay. And so what do you think is a reviewer's responsibility, or what is a consumer's responsibility? Because I don't think this is exclusively a function of criticism or being a reviewer. How does one express one opinion in that context, or what does one have to say? Talk more about that situation.
Well, I just think that...
You're fascinating me, Walker. I want you to say more.
I'm sorry. I'm very sorry. I'm saying if it is a reviewer, then they just have to just fall back on their experiences, right? And the fact that... And to be constant, right? If they just constantly review games, people understand why they think this particular way or what about that particular game they didn't like.
Yeah, it's weird. As a reviewer, sometimes I've struggled with this because sometimes I dislike a game and I know it's because just of very particular preferences that I have. If it's a spatial puzzle game, I'm probably not going to enjoy it. If it's an abstract game, I'm probably not going to enjoy it. If it's a game about sports, I'm probably not going to enjoy it. All these things, you know. Categories of games, either thematically or mechanically. And I don't know, even in that case, how much it is appropriate to say, well, I didn't like it, but everyone else at the table seemed to like it. Because I think, insofar, and this is getting very self-referential, usually I reserve this for so very wrong about all the games you like are bad, but nonetheless, here's where we are. I question the legitimacy of a reviewer trying to borrow someone else's viewpoint, or trying to express somebody else's viewpoint. If what we do has any value, it's because we have a viewpoint and we express it. And I don't know that it has much of a value for us to try to go too deep into why Huey, Dewey, or Louie, or anyone else likes or disliked a particular experience. You can note, very much I think as a footnote, I seem to be the only one that likes this game, or I seem to be the only one that dislikes this game. But I think that that's very much a footnote, because the more you try to adopt somebody else's perspective, I think the less you have to say of substance.
Agreed.
Do you think that this is a perspective that is broadly shared? Like, do you consume lots of board game media where you feel like people are not doing this?
No, it was just like when I'm seeing all these top 10, you know, because the year just ended, so there's all these, you know, top 10 games.
Yeah, everybody that does top 10 lists at the end of the year is a chump.
I know, I 100% sellouts. Agree. And then I see some of these games that have made, you know, their top three.
Name names, Walker.
No, I'm not naming any names, nor am I naming games. I'm just saying, and we felt as though there was definite issues with these particular games, mm-hmm. that they didn't even make our list. I'm not saying that, you know, our lists are, you know,
definitive,
the be all end all of lists, but these games had definite problems, yet they made like their top three. And I'm just trying to justify these choices. Did they get caught up in the hype? Did they just have great experiences because the game was so accessible to everybody, or the community at large, for whatever reason, you know, grasped this game and played it a lot, things like that. I'm just wondering if it was just sort of like an experience type game as opposed to a mechanically sound game type thing.
Well, that actually segues neatly into the other bucket of observations that I have, which is to say that although I don't want to engage in the appeal to popularity fallacy, and I don't think that the popularity of a game has any necessary connection to its quality as design work, because we know lots of incredibly well-designed games that aren't very popular, whereas we know lots of, we think, very badly designed games that... Anyway, what are the other virtues of a game being incredibly popular? Is there any value above and beyond it as a game to it being popular? And I think one of them is, you touched on this, as a social facilitator. This is one of those aspects of the hobby that very rightfully I get criticized for not emphasizing enough. We are not evangelists of fun. We're not enthusiasm merchants. That's not what we do. And there is a virtue in a game just being that sort of social lubricant or social facilitator. I promised myself I wasn't going to use the term social lubricant because it sounds awful, as a social facilitator to good group dynamics. And some badly designed games...
Are you lubricating my facilitator?
No, I'm lubricating your society.
Gotcha.
And there are benefits of these things. Generally speaking, we're talking about relatively accessible games. I think that's largely the category we're talking about. There's a benefit to having a game where you know that there's going to be no rules explanation because it's so popular, everyone's familiar with it. And I've felt this before. I remember back when I was a little bit more in step with Euro design principles. Like, I've always been a fundamentally, I think, primarily a Euro gamer since I've entered the hobby to a large extent. That shifted a little bit having fallen into your company. But I don't like Roland Wrights. I don't like Vitale Lacerda. I don't like a lot of this other stuff. So I feel like I'm kind of drifting out from what's popular. And there is a kind of cost to this. I remember how nice it was immediately after the release of Dominion in particular. I did a lot of traveling the year Dominion got released. And I knew that any public game gathering I would go to, somebody would be playing Dominion, and I could just sit down and play Dominion, and nobody there would need a rules explanation, and everyone was going to be on the same page, and it was a great way, in an instance where I was already introducing myself to strangers, whereby there wasn't this additional cognitive load of understanding a new game or being the new guy or anything. It's like, ah, we're all on the same page here. Let's all play Dominion.
That's right.
That was nice.
Same thing with Catan or Monopoly. These are games that everyone knows the rules. You don't need the
book. Well, no, nobody knows. Nobody plays by the rules of Monopoly, but yes.
And same thing with the online community, right? You'll be able to go online and share your experiences and feel part of something, right? Everyone's playing the same game. Either if it's not with you, it's with other people. So you're sharing experiences. You will get answers to whatever rules you have, because you know you'll post them up, they'll be answered immediately because there's so many people playing this game, and like you said, you're bound to find someone to play it with.
And this is one aspect in which we joke about how we're elitist snobs, but one thing I think I've never really done, not lately anyway, not since becoming an adult, is other than the bounds of this podcast, where presumably you're listening to hear me talk about things, I don't harsh people's buzzes, right? If people are enthusing in my earshot about a game that I think is utter garbage, I'm not going to jump in and talk about how I think the game is utter garbage. I'm going to let them have their enthusiasm. You're the same way. You're not going to stomp on someone's delight. And so as a sort of establisher, this is my second large category of things, as helping to establish group identity, a lot of these popular games are very good at doing that. You talked just a couple weeks ago about how you overheard conversations in a game store where games that we thought are very mediocre were being praised to the sky and you had to hold your tongue. And I was there. I did the same thing. I had sort of the opposite experience recently. So again, under the category of establishing a group identity and how sort of touchstone popular games are good at doing that, the last time I remember that happening where I was fully on board, I think, was Blood Rage. I think that was the last time where a game got released where it was the big thing and everyone was on board. And I was like, yes, this is excellent. Let's all play this thing. I remember I was watching a movie today, actually, where it became very clear about halfway through that the movie expected me to care and know very deeply about this particular member of the royal family circa 1920-something. And I didn't know what the hell they were talking about. I didn't know who this person was. It didn't mean anything to me. And it was just a subtle reminder that a lot of these things, a lot of these cultural products, whether they're movies or music or board games, help establish a group identity. And so when there are these big touchstone events and when everyone knows how to play and when everyone's on board and when everyone's playing, it helps to, you know, make the hobby and groups more inclusive, and it just helps underscore that we're all in this together.
True, and what you just said there, and you talked about it earlier as well with her Sacra Arms, when games are popular like that, people are going to make translation, so the game will be available in more languages. So the Agricola stickers, the Sacra Arms inserts, so the more popular game is, the more languages it's going to be available in. And the fact that it's just going to be more available in general, because if it's a widely popular game, then it's going to be reprinted more often, and therefore be more accessible.
Yeah, even a successful design, but you're right, because the new distribution models, where everything is more or less a periodical, even the successful designs go out of print in about 5 hot seconds and are not reprinted for another year or so. The very popular games, those big touchstone games, they generally speaking, with a couple of months of a blip here and there, tend to be pretty reliably accessible, which is pretty good.
Other benefits is that you might get a deluxified copy of it because it's popular. There'll be third party upgrades like inserts and upgraded components and all sorts of fancy stuff. Tournaments. Because it's a popular game, there might be organized tournaments, which is sometimes a good thing, sometimes an awfully terrible thing.
Well, on that topic, just as a footnote, all of this applies primarily to board games. If you are talking about miniatures games, well then, popularity is pretty much the single most important thing to consider when getting into a miniatures game, because if you don't have an opponent, spending a couple $100 on miniatures for a system is pretty pointless. And so that is the first and best advice that you always give to somebody considering a new miniature system. Do people play it in your area? If not, we strongly recommend not, so just keep that in mind.
It also brings new people into the hobby, right? the more popular a game is, then the more people play it, the more people hear about it, and, you know, it brings more and more people into the hobby.
And that's one of the great ways to break down gatekeeping. You know, gatekeeping, the unfortunate attitude is like, ugh, no, real gamers don't do that. I remember when Wingspan was first released, and I'm sure that nothing you've said thus far has anything to do with Wingspan. Nothing whatsoever.
Not a single thing.
I think two different people asked me independently that were not gamers, saying, oh, you know a lot about games. Have you heard about this thing? I read about it at this place or whatever. Or I know someone who's a birder and whatever. Have you heard about this Wingspan? And sure enough, it's an opportunity to bring new people in. And if I weren't such a snob, or if I'd had one of the three copies available at that point, I could have been like, yes, we play Wingspan. Come down to the store. Descend into the basement of socially maladapted malcontents, and you can come join it. Like, no, there's a benefit to something being part of the zeitgeist. It is fun to be part of the big group that is all having the same experience together.
Exactly.
I think it's one of the reasons why people like Marvel movies so much. Big tentpole franchises. Everyone gets to be on the same page. You're all part of the same moment. And now, sometimes, of course, this has a little bit of a nefarious influence, right? If everybody's on the same page with a game, if it's part of a dynamic, whether it's a group dynamic or a broader gamer dynamic, sometimes there's this exclusionary pressure if you're not already on board. Actually, just last week at our local game store at game night, there was a game of Secret Hitler going on, which is very much the local social deduction game of choice, unfortunately. And one of the people there who's relatively new, it was round three or four before it was revealed that he didn't know how the game was played and he was just winging it. Because it's awkward to be the one person at a table of 10 to say, I don't know how this works. Please explain it to me.
Yeah, what? I don't know what's going on.
So, you know, he just decided to fake it until...
That's how strong Secret Hitler is. The other thing I have here is I can get more competitive in a good way, because more people are playing the game more often. It's a game that comes back to the table more often. So, you know, new interesting strategies will come about and, you know, it'll be, you know, introduce this nice competitive atmosphere.
Sticking to popular releases is very much a good way to fight back against the endless cult of the new. You can just say, look, I want there to be a sufficient penetration and a sufficient user base before I move on to the next thing. And that I think is a reasonable metric as anything else.
Gives the counterfeiters something new to work on.
Oh, yeah, you got to keep them employed. Exactly. It's a job creator.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, they probably get bored doing the same old, you know, Castles of Burgundy.
It's a creative industry, right?
Over and over again.
They're artists. You have to give them new material.
Exactly.
I think this has been an interesting discussion both of aesthetics and of market dynamics.
I agree. That's why I love these discussions.
I'm glad you got something out of it, Walker. Too bad none of our listeners do. Thank you very much for joining us for So Very Wrong About Games. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can reach Walker via his email, justrolledadice@gmail.com. That's JUSTROLLDADICE @gmail.com. You can reach me, Mark Bigney, on Twitter @TheGamesYouLike. For more public discussion, you can find the So Very Wrong About Games Facebook page, or you can check out our Board Game Geek Guild, which is guild number 3236. We're almost at 1,000 users, Walker.
I know, right?
And you can find us on Patreon. We read everything you send us, and we'll get back to you if we can. Thanks again for tuning in, and we hope to see you again soon.
Speaking of 1,000 users at our guild, if you agree or disagree with anything we say, please come to our guild. Oh, wait, I had to do this.
No,
please send an email to aircanada.com. I'm sure they care. We don't. See you next week.
You've been listening to So Very Wrong About Games, produced by Michael Walker and edited by Mark Bigney. Special thanks goes to What Does It Eat for generously allowing us to use their most excellent song, FOS, as our theme. You can find them at whatdoeseteat.com. You can reach us by email at soverywrongaboutgames@gmail.com or on Twitter @sowronggames. Thanks very much, see you next time, and always, try to be right, but remember you are so very wrong.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.